Part 2, Crypt and Crucible. It must be clear from the very fact of their venturing here that there was an element of the unorthodox in monks who came to the West to plant the seedling of Vedanta. In some, there was a heavy dose of orthodoxy mixed in, producing bizarre combinations. This is seen in Swami Kanananda, who, with a background of a Brahmin family of South India, a regal family at that, retained many vestiges of the traditions of that inheritance. He had constructed the prayer hall and shrine on the pattern of a theater, with audience, as it were, squatting on the lower portion, facing west, and stage occupied by all that was holy. Throughout the order, the shrine area receives special attention as regards its purity and sanctity, sometimes to an extraordinary degree. But I was hardly prepared to find that here it was completely separated from the worshippers and meditators by a solid sheet of glass the width of the room. At least 3/4 inch thick and perfectly transparent, it wasn't immediately visible. It extended almost to the ceiling, leaving just enough of a gap for the passage of air, and this was a large room. Behind the partition was one of the largest pictures of Sri Ramakrishna I had ever seen. It was a photographic enlargement of one of the original prints. Beside and behind him, on the spacious shrine table, and on the mantelpiece against the wall, was arranged a large assortment of various deities, Kali, Krishna, Buddha, Shiva, Christ. Through the side door into the shrine room, no one passed save Swami himself and the boy serving as priest, and, on occasion, those to be initiated. But that only after a complete bath and fresh clothes. Shades of San Francisco. But this seemed designed to defend a sterile laboratory. It was only much later that I learned that the glass wall had not been part of Swami's original design, but had been necessitated by an act of vandalism some years before. What role does such external ritual purity play in the building up of a store of psychic and mystical power? I have often pondered it. I was struck with admiration for Swami's zeal regarding ritual purity. For as I came to know him better and saw the influence he wielded, the sources of which could not be discovered simply by reckoning the visible factors, the more I felt that in his life and work such a connection was being demonstrated. I believe he attempted also at one point to regiment the prayer hall visitors and users by insisting on their having a bath before coming, a proposal found, not surprisingly, unfeasible. At major celebrations, Swami Kanananda would perform the puja himself, just as he often did the vesper service when feeling well enough. He was meticulous in the extreme about the arrangements and purity of the offerings. In the ceremony itself, he would become like one lost. A current of uplifting spiritual consciousness would be initiated, which hardly anyone could avoid noticing and being affected by in one way or another. As one devotee remarked, it was strange and moving to see one who was at times so masterful and full of fire become patently humble as he sat there, surrounded by banks of flowers. He did something else I had never seen others do. He would linger around the door of his room after worship was over, evidently scrutinizing the effects it had had on the various devotees as they emerged from the prayer hall. It was not something I read into it. He admitted it to at least one person. Most of his day, Swami spent in his own room, which served as bedroom, living room, and office, and has already been described. There he gave himself the necessary twice daily injections of insulin. There he read his mail, the material and proofs for the magazine, prepared his lectures. There, too, he spent a great deal of time in bed. It had surely preserved him to this age of 70 years, the amount of bed rest he had taken over so many of those years. Who knows whether he was asleep? It was a great matter for speculation for the novices. What we do know is that he would come to the tea table after one of those long naps and say to his secretary, "Have you heard from M lately?" "No." "Write to her. She is ill." Or, "Go and call on N, and you can take her some prasad." Or, "Send a little money to S. He needs it." This information did not come from the mail. Once he told a devotee who was feeling overpressed with work and worries, "It will be easier when you reach my age. You can shut your eyes and everybody will think you are sleeping. They will not disturb you. But really you will be meditating and you will gain great spiritual strength." Reducing his metabolic needs undoubtedly helped Swami Kalananda to undertake the fasting for which he was famous. I did not see it in my time, which was characterized by his eating each meal precisely as prescribed by his medical regimen, down to the half ounce. But I heard that he used to fast on the slightest excuse. He was known to live on nothing but fruit juice or milk for as many as 9 days before a major festival, such as the Durga Puja. Speaking of food, I was released from the strict rule of vegetarianism enveloping 68 Dukes Avenue, Muswell Hill, in a most interesting way. Still recuperating, and on doctor's advice, I ate fish. Swami told me to go and buy it at the market and take it into the little used kitchen of number 66, the women's retreat house next door, and cook it there, which I did. The ashrama's atmosphere of spiritual intensity, engendered by the meditation periods and the ritual scrupulosity, Swami knew how to preserve, even in the relaxation and recreation of the dining hall. It was here where we all gathered, brahmacharis and devotees alike, to have with our coffee, tea, and so on, his jokes told with twinkling eyes and a giddy laugh, and his outlandish stories. One of his favorites was that of the flying serpents of Sargachi near Murshidabad, Bengal. He had lived there, writing letters in English for Swami Akandananda, one of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. So when the latter pressed him to remain there with him, there was the expectation that the young monk would wish to avail himself of such an opportunity. Swami Akandananda, however, had seen in the dusk a snake jump over a well. This and the prevalence of dysentery in the area persuaded him to forego the privilege of staying with Swami Akandananda. At the meal or tea table, Swami often rose above himself, so to speak, in brilliance of wit, brightness of spirit, sweetness of expression, and personal inspiration. That humor of his cannot be quoted or exemplified. It verged on the zany and took time to get accustomed to. Blithe spirit was an expression of that time, and it often came to my mind. At other moments, there was a vibrant silence. No void, but a silence filled to the brim, bringing inwardness and peace. Not seldom there were depth charges, pungent personal comments, comprehended by the party targeted, if not by the others present. One never knew what to expect. Nowhere was the guru more in evidence than here at the table, and probably nowhere better received. There were good windows in the kitchen from which one could view the roomy backyard and the squirrel living in the big shade tree. It too had found the secret of Swami's heart and occupied a good niche there. Swami would see that his friend the squirrel had respectable food offerings, intimately tendered, and would come down and report to us its antics. I was a fool not to have noted down on paper or in mind these and many other seemingly trivial transient things, for they are the very stuff of biography. But I was still dazed by having moved, still puzzling over whether I could live with this strange man. Swami Kanananda had been a good walker in healthier days. In his early years in London, he had been an intrepid explorer, and in this way he had seen many parts of the city. He told us to walk. We usually did not go far, but it was a joy in good weather to stroll in the company of a brother, or alone up to the hilltop, religiously to circumambulate grand old Alexandra Palace, and speculate on that queen's personal martyrdom and other wisps of British history of which the fog and crisp air were redolent. Going out was hedged, however, by certain important strictures, especially for Swami Kanananda. He asserted them to be astrological. Thursday afternoon was inauspicious, as a matter of course. Well, hadn't the master observed all these things, he would say. One came to feel that after the Shruti, the primary scripture of revelation, it was the Panchika, the almanac, prescribing the various auspicious hours and days, as well as those not so, that held sway over our life. Swami kept in his room a chalkboard with various cautions and reminders written there. Saturday morning, don't go out. Don't write letters next Wednesday. See that B.F. doesn't arrive Monday morning. Not only that, it was possible for the auspiciousness to change within the course of the day. Abrupt decisions would be made. Sudden changes of plan. We might be all set to make a visit to Holland Park Ashrama, and Swami would call down the stairs, "No, we can't go today." There were some who suspected that all this was designed to make us flexible. Aside from its possible perversity, that was not, I think, true. I cannot demonstrate what dire catastrophes were obviated by all this, but Swami Kanananda believed in the Panchika. He was a strong-willed man, not given to fear, one whose tone of voice or stare was sufficient to settle promptly any dispute. Yet, if the question of astrology's validity was raised with him, he would discuss it coolly, rationally, And if you still had doubts, you would toss the whole thing off with a rising inflection of excitement. But these things do work, you know. Or Sri Ramakrishna himself paid attention to all this. Yet his dealing was individual with the various students, and he told at least one, "Astrology is not for you. For you, meditation."